Last time we physically saw each other, I suggested that gold was going to hit 3,000 at the turn of this year. So we're definitely moving up past that. And to get to the end first, and then I'll work back, I do think we can get to a 5,000 level in the next few years. But all of these factors that are in play right now have made gold not just a favorite.
Nomi Prinz, good morning to you. How are you, my friend?
I am great. So awesome to see you again.
It's really great to see you. I would like to jump right into it. It's really all over the news and really all over the markets. As you're aware, and I'm an active trader and investor, is really the gold market. It's ripping. Silver's somewhat followed, but I'd love your two cents on that. What's this move due to, and what are you seeing in the markets with gold and silver?
Yeah, so last time we physically saw each other, I suggested that gold was going to hit 3,000 at the turn of this year. So we're definitely moving up past that. And to get to the end first, and then I'll work back, I do think we can get to a 5,000 level in the next few years. But all of these factors that are in play right now have made gold not just a favorite of, you know, gold bugs per se, that used to be maybe a smaller, quieter group. But really, gold has become the safety net for so many uncertainties in the world and also changes. So here's what we're dealing with and why gold will continue to move up. First, obviously, there's the uncertainty over tariffs, which have pushed gold recently, or been one of the factors to push gold recently. When tariff uncertainty arises, because of the second reason, which is central bank buying and sovereign fund buying, other national buying of gold at the sort of higher levels, there is this combination of buying that's already happening for diversification to the dollar, diversification to the U.S., repolarizing concentrating other entities towards each other around China, Pan-Asia, Europe, and so forth to increase their trade routes with each other. And have gold be the backdrop of that. There's also general wealth preservation during uncertain times, and we are seeing a stagnating economy right now. And there's gold buying because there's a FOMO creeping into it for those people and institutions, institutional buyers and buying that haven't participated in the current levels that they're starting to participate in, but also I think where they can go to if gold continues, which I believe it will, to be that anchor of global repositioning and uncertainty. So there's a lot of tailwinds to gold. Now, there's headwinds to everything. There's up and down in the market and so forth. But I think the tailwinds right now that we're seeing and that are going to keep on accumulating are just far stronger than any interim headwind, because they are about full-on repositioning globally, and also repositioning from the standpoint of risk to individuals and to institutions. So those are the factors that we see driving gold, and that'll continue to drive gold. Silver is a bit of a different animal. Obviously, silver is more volatile than gold, and so there it doesn't have that same constant trend up. Although if we look at where silver is right now, it's definitely back to trending up again. It does bump around more because it doesn't have that same cachet in terms of new institutional buying, even individual buying, and certainly central bank buying yet. Gold is considered a reserve asset for central banks. The BIS, Bank of International Settlements, made it so. And so there is a different role that gold has. Silver, though, on the other hand, is allowed to be a reserve asset. It's just not as popular yet, but that path is there. So meanwhile, we have other headwinds to silver, which have to do with the economy. Do we need as much silver right now? Are we having industrial growth right now? Is it slowing down? But at the end of the day, none of that really matters for silver, because what is coming, the demand for silver industrially and also from a central bank and diversification perspective, relative to the supply that is outside of the ground, will continue to move silver prices higher. The other, though, headwind for silver is It does tend to get a lot of paper movement back and forth. We call it manipulation, just sort of moving the market without actually having physical silver to back some of those positions. That's a phenomenon that happens more in silver than in gold. Why? Because silver is cheaper. It's just easier to do that. And so that's one of the reasons, and we do see some of those headwinds keeping the momentum of silver from moving at the moment as quickly as gold. But all the factors are similar that will drive.
So it's hard for me to ask a follow-up question with that, because you basically answered every single follow-up question that I was writing down. So well done. But I would like to say, or maybe it's a question or even a paraphrase, it's really what you see, the things that have propelled gold to these current heights, it's really going to be the same thing that you see this moving it to 5,000, whenever that is, or 5,000 plus, whenever that is. It's just really the same wind at the, that's, I want to say, yeah, the same things that are happening right now. Is that right? What you're saying?
Yeah. And they're consolidating, right? So for example, yeah. I was just over in Europe for a month, did a bunch of meetings across some countries. And one of the places I went was the Austrian Mint, which basically is one of the most sort of artistically oriented coin producers of gold and silver coins in the world, and a long history and all of that. They melt pure gold bars that come in from Switzerland into like liquid gold that goes into this really, really multiple step quality artistry process to make these coins. But they have adjacent to the mint, which is not open to visitors. I had a specific connection there, but where people can just come in, they have to have appointments. They can't just sort of walk in off the street and be like, hey, I want to buy gold, but they can get the appointment right there, take a number like at a deli and be like, hey, your number, whatever, for this gold booth. And also silver. And there is just a lot of just regular people coming in to buy gold. And I had asked the Mint about that. And they said, well, in addition to all of the things that we covered just now, Andy, there's still fear in Europe. And it is actually repositioning Europe and defense and a whole lot of other things financially and from a policy and geopolitical perspective. But what gold buying was something that happened across Europe during times of war, during times of uncertainty. And, people would find ways to buy it, to hold it, to save it, to store it. And that attitude has been creeping up more. It creeped up immediately after the Ukraine war began, this iteration and Russia invaded in 2022. But now this particular period, even though there's a lot of conversation about, well, will there be a truce? Will there not? What will Russia do, et cetera? There's a lot of angst around that European individual and sort of smaller investor about what that might look like. And angst actually creates another reason, another ripple towards buying gold and buying silver as an ancillary thing, because it is just cheaper. Like when I was there, I bought a silver coin just as a commemoration everywhere of the Philharmonic series, which they have. I did not buy a gold coin. But so that's one of the things that people though are doing. And there was just more of them coming in to do that, not just that day, but in general during this period.
So that is awesome, actually. And it's really cool to hear that you had it first on knowledge, just anecdotally watching with your own eyes. And I say anecdotally with all due respect, just that's really, really fantastic to hear and see. I was going to pin Europe, but let's go there now. I've talked to several different analysts, writers, leaders in the industry or whatever, thinkers, and really Europe, about Europe, and you're somewhat falling apart, or it is falling apart right now. What are your comments on Europe? Do you hold that position? And where is this going with Europe?
Yeah, so there's a lot of pockets to that. Europe's economy is definitely slowing overall. There are certain major countries like Germany that carry the weight of economic growth for Europe that is falling behind. The UK is basically stagnant. It's a little bit better than that. Then there are countries in Europe, for example Spain, which within Western Europe is having quite a move upward. So what we're seeing is in Europe, there's a general sort of EU average economic slowdown. But then there's also these pockets of countries where, for example, in Spain, technology is going up a tear. Switzerland, which is not counted in the EU kind of per se, but it's there, is also seeing some of that. And in pharmaceuticals, which is one of their things as well. So there's certain pockets where there is specific sector or like country growth, but overall, there are definitely some issues, as there is in the UK, and all the projections that you see on the ground, and sort of also from official sources like the IMF, RISI, or EU, or Bank of England, are seeing that. And from the standpoint of just being there as well, you know, beyond the numbers, you know, the below 2% numbers, the below 1% numbers for the UK in terms of growth, there is more, you know, sort of general uncertainty in terms of consumer purchases and going out and that sort of thing, for which there are numbers, but also which you kind of see, except in the countries that are doing well. So you can walk around Barcelona, there's no sign of that. So it really is a bit bifurcated. Now, what we're also seeing, though, there's an area of large growth in Europe, we just wrote about, which is the defense sector, where because of what has happened since Ukraine, but also most recently with the Trump administration policies related to funding, whether it's NATO or whatever happens between the Ukraine and Russia, is that there's been this growth of defense and that sort of related infrastructure spending, which has been real growth. I mean, Germany has been very reticent about, for example, being above a 2% of GDP level in NATO. Now they're above 2%. But then you have something like Poland, which is a 4.5%. So there's different numbers there. But also there's a proposal now for 150 billion euro defense fund to augment whatever else is going on there. The UK is coming up with proposals. So there's a lot of funding that's being considered and I believe will be found, because I think you're going to get private investors on the back of this as well, as happens in that particular sector as well. And that sector requires infrastructure, requires AI, requires technology, requires energy. So there are codependent sectors of growth within an overall sort of stagflating environment.
Got it. Steve, I want to give you an opportunity to ask any questions that you have. I have several more, but go ahead, Steve.
Well, I've got some other questions regarding the Fed and stuff. Why don't you go ahead while we're on Europe?
Okay. Yeah. So do you happening? I have family. My wife is from Europe. My in-laws live in Europe. My daughter's going to Europe to live at the end of the year, or I should say at the end of this fall. So in September, October. Anyways, so what I'm trying to get at, do you see Europe potentially, do you see the euro? And that's different than Europe, but the EU, I should say. Do you see it cracking or breaking even apart? Is that even a remote possibility?
I think it's less of a possibility now than, you know, I might have said it was in the past. But we have seen the euro and the sterling, actually the British pound, outperform the dollar during this period of tariff-related uncertainty and sort of repositioning of trade agreements with respect to Asia, with respect to Pan-Asia, with respect to within European countries. And so we have seen spurts of currency strength come into this overall economic malaise, which also the U.S. is kind of facing to an extent as well. But so we do see that. And typically what happens is if there's more economic uncertainty or just countries are really different from each other, there's more of a potential for things to rip apart. Like when Germany's really, really strong and France is strong, and Western countries are really strong, like all of them, then it's like, well, is our Eastern countries going to keep up? And, you know, and then there's political views, or there's far right to sort of middle and all of that. And how is that going to tear? I think right now, that's not the economic part of this equation is not really ripping, going to rip Europe apart. I think what's going to happen in general to the euro is that we could actually continue to see it strengthen a bit relative to the dollar, mostly because of the uncertainty that's being placed on the dollar now because of tariffs and other types of policies and what other countries do because of that and the relationships they strengthen because of that. So, for example, since 2018, Europe has traded. The increase in Europe's trade with China has outpaced the increase of Europe's trade with the U.S. So there's already been a trend towards repositioning and sort of broadening trade partners and with the import-export and profitability potential that can bring. So I think that's going to keep Europe, all of that path glued together. UK versus Europe. We've done the Brexit thing, so that's over. But I do think there's a lot because of the defense sector and infrastructure. I think there's a lot more conversations happening now than, say, a few months ago between the UK and Europe about coordinating more. I mean, some of them are a bit acerbic, you know, like, you're going to be in our fund, you're not going to be in our fund, you have to do this, you're not going to do this, from Europe with respect to the UK. But I think overall, there's a desire of the UK to work both closely with the United States and keep that relationship, but also re-deepen their relationship with Europe, which would be good for both economies. And I don't think that plays into the EU splitting any more so. I think, you know, that was kind of it, UK leaving.
Got it. You know, just as mentioned, as a trade, not that I'm recommending this, but I appreciate your comments on the euro. Just from, if that is a contrarian play right there, it's strengthening against the dollar. Really, I would see it almost just about anything, just because it's, correct me if I'm wrong, it's not very well liked right now or loud right now. Let me ask you this, and I'll let Steve take it. So do you see Europe, that really raises the question, who's going to be their trade partner? Then it would be, do you see them going, continuing to go east towards China, if you would, as, yeah. Is that what you see, or even potentially Russia? I know that's crazy.
Well, Russia, I mean, there's still a lot of, obviously, tension around Russia's policy and Russia's invasion in the Ukraine. That's one of the reasons for this burst of defense spending. It's not a burst of defense spending because of an increase of trust for Russian policy. It's the opposite. So from an economic standpoint, there's trade that's still going on between Russia and the rest of Europe in energy and LNG, in things that have to happen. So I don't see that necessarily increasing. I mean, if there is a sort of peace that is acceptable on all sides, and I think that's going to take more than just an agreement with the United States. It's going to take seeing what actually happens and how it actually unfolds. It's not clear that, or I don't think that Russia, the EU is going to sort of increase above what it already has with respect to Russia until that, and if that happens. However, the trade with China and the trade with India and the trade with Japan and the trade with Pan Asia has been increasing, as has the trade been with some of the South American countries. So there is a broadening. For example, Italy and Brazil have had a longstanding partnership relationship, and there is an influx of energy investment from Italy now that has increased recently into Brazil for the goal of processing more in Brazil, where energy is cheaper to process, and then having those products come back out to Italy. So there's growth kind of throughout the world in terms of partnerships in Europe. But that said, Europasta, if it's really going to capitalize on this and become stronger, it has to really make these moves. It really has to, you know, strategize how to sort of grow these parts of the economy. And right now that's tenuous.
Yeah. Interesting. And one last question then is, you see, you mentioned defense, and I would agree with you. That's been, if you just got to dig a little bit, that's been all over the news where, again, the whole tension with NATO, or the U.S. tension with NATO, and Europe just saying, hey, we're going to have to spend more on defense and support this more.
Yes.
That really plays into, that would be very inflationary in Europe, no?
It would be if everything was getting funding throughout Europe. I think what tends to happen when we think about inflation, there's this sort of monetary inflation, like money flowing in and what that does to prices. But to the extent that the defense industry is a classic combination of a public-private partnership, really. And so there will be private money as well as public money. And it is a small section of the overall economy. It's just one that is growing. So it's not really going to have that much of an impact, I don't think, on the overall inflation picture, just because of the position it plays within the full economy. So I don't really see that happening.
Got it.
But I will say, Tanya, we've done a bunch of pieces on this in Print Sites recently, again, because I was just there. But also because we have looked at different geographies on the world that will benefit from higher growth relative to inflation, and in parts of Europe fit that bill. If things can happen in a sort of, you know, all the dots connect manner, like Spain, for example. Spain's actually has inflation, but it's kind of lower comparative inflation, yet higher comparative growth. So, I mean, that can happen. And in certain industries, we also look at Pan-Asia, China as a growth area, Vietnam, Indonesia, and so forth, as well as some of the key emerging market countries with mining, with processing, with real assets that are getting involved more with trade. You know, for example, Chile or Ecuador, now it's calmer, and Brazil. So we have,
Steve, go ahead. What was your question?
No, I mean, I do want to pivot a little bit here. If you can talk a little bit about the Federal Reserve and kind of how they're affecting the markets and the transparency and communication issues, if you can talk a little bit more about that here.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we just had the recent communication from the Fed and Chairman Powell that they didn't do anything with rates one way or another at their last FOMC meeting earlier this month. But what they did do was, I thought, more of a sign as to where they're going, which was they cut back on their quantitative tightening quite substantially. So rather than them letting $25 billion worth of treasuries, and this is off of a $6.7 trillion asset book, it's not a lot anyway per month, but rather than let $25 billion of treasuries roll off and not replace them, so tighten the amount of assets they hold, they reduced it to 5. Which is significant, because 5 to me is kind of like zero. It's just kind of a way to save face and not say zero. But what it indicates is concerns about liquidity, about the level of 10-year yields and that part of the curve, about losses that are unrealized but mounting on the books of banks, of losses that are mounting very quickly on the book of the Fed in terms of the money it gets in interest from banks that it's supposed to remit or send to the U.S. Treasury Department, of which it's in $250 billion hole. So all of these things are related to the overhang of the rates having been raised so quickly to fight inflation, yet not having dropped enough to plug these holes and these gaps in financing losses and interest payments and just the general problems with debt all around in banks and on the Fed's own balance sheet. So I think what's going to have to happen is Powell, and he started to say this sort of between the lines at the last meeting, by focusing on lowered growth on the forecast of the Fed's growth being down from 2.1% to 1.7%, so under 2, even though inflation's a little bit over. They forecast inflation to rise from 2.4 to 2.8. But I mean, these are all semantics. Everything's kind of, economic growth is slowing, inflation's not really, but the Fed can't actually stick an inflation landing no matter what they try to do unless the economy slows down. But if the economy is slowing down more quickly than that, then they're going to have to recognize what role they might need to play in stimulating the economy, the markets, and this tension between interest payments at higher rates and refinancing some of that. For businesses in particular, to alleviate some of that growing pain. So the Fed's in this weird spot that they keep on being in this spot, really, because they tend to stick too long to one narrative and then they forget like the other narratives that are happening. So it's like a really emotional body, I think. And if they start to really look at the data, and this pivot in language to me means they're doing that to economic slowdown, I think we're going to get more rate cuts than the 50 basis points that they had forecast in December and that they had held this month between now and the end of the year, because they're going to have to. And I think the minute they start with some clearer language as to everything we just said here, slow down versus whatever they say about inflation at that moment, the markets will like that overall, particularly if it coincides with more clarity on tariffs. And if those things don't happen around the same time, we're going to continue to see this bumpy ride.
So in terms of what they're communicating, how they're doing it, in terms of what they're doing, could you kind of help me get inside the mind of the Feds and just help me understand what are they thinking? What's the strategy? What's the logic? If you can also tell me what you think what they believe their role is, and maybe you can expound on that from Noemi Prince.
It's so interesting because I think the Fed cottoned on to this role of, superhero inflation fighter, right? having been sort of behind it, and then they sort of got there and they're like, okay, this is going to be our thing. So the official dual mandate, which actually isn't fighting inflation, it's price stability, which they're interpreting to mean fighting inflation and full employment. They, you know, sort of erred on that side of inflation fighting. And that's one of the reasons we went from zero to, you know, 5.5% on rates in sort of the fastest period of time, or comparatively fast, in how the Fed operates historically. But they've attached themselves. This is why I say they're kind of emotional. They've attached themselves to this idea that they actually can control inflation. And they, and I think the media, I think a lot of people, a lot of smart analysts have kind of bought into that narrative that they can't. And because they can't, it creates this problem where they're trying to portray themselves as being able to do one thing. The narrative around that one thing has become its own identity entity. So it's substantiating their saying that they can fight inflation and get it down below 2% because they did something. And that just detaches them from looking at data coming in as it comes in, because they're kind of attached to this narrative and their role, but they're not attached to the numbers coming in. This is what we're seeing. Their role is, yes, to sort of be there for stability and liquidity. They were created to give liquidity to the banking system. The banking system is choking. I'm not saying it is a good thing that they're there to give liquidity to the banking system, as opposed to the banking system sort of figuring out itself. But that is the Fed that we have. That is the Fed that was created since 1913. And, you know, dissecting that's a whole other conversation, very long conversation. But that's where they're at right now. They're trying to do one thing and somewhat missing what's happening because of what they're trying to do or their role in it.
So this is really why one of the big reasons I see, and correct me if I'm wrong, why gold market has just been screaming is just exactly this.
Yeah. I mean, their messaging is, I mean, it's clear, but it's off again because of what they believe and portray they can control, but kind of can't, and what they're looking at to maintain their own narrative in all of this. And gold is like, well, it's really hard to know what they're going to do, when they're going to do it. But gold has value in and of itself, regardless of whether or when the Fed decides to cut or raise rates. What's been really interesting about this cycle of the bull market for gold is that gold has risen in both of those scenarios. It's risen as rates have come up. It's risen as rates have come down. It's risen during periods of less tariff uncertainty. It's risen with more tariff uncertainty. It continues to get purchased in record amounts by central banks trying to diversify against currency, and particularly the dollar. And it's more attractive to long-term investors or individuals who just want to hold on to something real. And it just has that appeal, that sort of port in the storms appeal, as well as all the historical wealth elements of it.
Yeah.
I'm
a big Jim Rickards fan.
Yeah.
We've been talking about.
Yep.
And you're very familiar with Jim.
Yeah.
He's been talking about $10,000 goal for a while. And
yes.
His play would be, if I remember him saying that 10%, you want to put 10% in gold bullion. Like, in terms of instability right now going on in this world, where do you, you know, for an everyday investor who's looking for stability in a world of chaos right now, where do you see a good safe play to go on? Hey, you probably want to think about investing in maybe bullion or gold stocks, or what are your thoughts on other places that might be stable?
Well, I have a follow-up question to that. You go ahead, Brian. Steve's asking for portfolio help.
Well, and we do that at Princeton. Not portfolio help, they're not advisors, but we do take a look holistically at what's happening geopolitically, economically, and financially, in terms of what we do suggest. And in terms of gold, we've been talking about this gold story for quite some time. And when I say story, I mean reality. And in terms of how you allocate, say a 5% to 10%, I think, allocation between gold, silver, and copper, with, I'd say, if you're going to do that, let's just call it 10%. And these numbers are really based on anyone's individual risk preference and all of that. But I suggest more on gold and copper than silver right now, because what we were just talking about was silver. But in general, I think those precious metals have a good spot in a long-term portfolio. And in terms of the miners, and that's physical, like whatever you can do physically, or even if you do an ETF, because I mean, it's harder. You feel it's too complicated to, you know, store gold coins or silver coins or whatever have you, that you look at ETFs that actually have, that are backed by physical gold, like, and because there are ones that are just paper, same thing with silver, and that they're ones that actually have more physical assets behind them. And with respect to miners, we've recommended some miners. You know, look us up on trend sites, but basically, the quality miners that have diversified active mines that are involved in mines that are already operational across the world. So you sort of blue blood miners, and then if you're for the more speculative in there, who have more sort of a stomach for the volatility that inherently comes into shares of miners and junior miners and in any commodity, I do think this is a good time to you know, have 1 or 2% of that allocation into the mining community for that kind of investor. And obviously, if you have more an appetite, or that's the only thing you're investing in, that's a whole other story. But we do recommend mining as part of, or miners as part of the gold equation.
On that note, I'm actually really interested right now in buying or de-risking, if you would, out of gold. That's a terrible thing to say, but so I've sold some of my gold holdings, not physical, but the miners, just because they've done so well since the beginning of the year. But I'm looking at energy plays as well as critical minerals. Talk to me a little bit about that. I know you're in that space somewhat, or the critical strategic space somewhat. I like them just because I think it's a huge contrarian play right now.
Absolutely. But
talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we actually have a piece coming out specifically on the critical minerals. I mean, I talk about them all the time, but like a new one that is tight.
So
so you got the scoop. Yeah, I think. Sign up now. But if we look at the executive order that just came out of the White House on supporting critical minerals and rare earths as a absolute component of national security and energy security, there's a lot in that. We sort of break it down, but there's a lot in that particular executive order that builds upon actually the Trump first administration that had opened up the book in the Department of Interior and Energy and Defense of looking at critical minerals as a thing that we needed to have, and creating that initial 50 critical minerals list, which includes rare earths. This goes deeper into that and talks about processing and onshore processing capacity as well for critical minerals, because 90% of it or 85% of it is done in China. So even if we were to mine more quickly some of the critical minerals that we have in the United States or of our closer allies, it still has to be processed somewhere. So this particular order kind of expands, and the numbers are connected to it, so we don't know how much is going to be allocated, but it sends a clear signal that it's not just about a reserve of raw supplies. It's also about growing the processing and manufacturing. To the extent that happens, we do have certain companies in the States. Energy Fuels, for example, is one that has an operating processing plant for, well, both uranium. It's the largest, I think, only operating plant for processing, and they mine as well uranium, and growing that into the rare earth space, critical mineral space. And so I think that looking at these types of companies and this space, it's a long play. When we talk about even, you know, what happened with President Trump talking about, you know, sort of doing a deal with Ukraine about their rare earths and what have you, and critical minerals, it's not that simple. I mean, these are things that have a many, many year lead time, as does anything in mining, and we don't have the processing capacity. But this stated that it is a priority of the administration. It's a through line to the last administration, actually just putting it into a different space. So, yes, it's not necessarily contrarian, but it's definitely contrarian from a timing standpoint, that you have to basically be there for a while and anticipate a good return, but over a lot of potential volatility, because the market's very small, you know, so as with anything, Look how long it took for so many people to sort of move into the idea of gold buying. And as you said, you know, there's still a lot of, they're still taking profit. And so the big gold miners, there's others that have just like walked out of the junior ones because they didn't outperform as well as the big ones because they're still processing, like even getting stuff out of the ground. There's just a lot of pieces. But this space is moving forward. It's only going to, you know, the magnetic aspect of energy storage for defense, for strategic missile systems, for AI development, for, you know, conversing with your ChatGPT. I mean, all of these things have elements of critical minerals as to, you know, energy related to storage and all of that. So this is all a huge growth area. Just it's going to require investors that recognize it could pop any moment, or it could just be a long haul with a lot of volatility. But yeah. It's a space we actively suggest.
Yeah, that's really what I remember you by. I mean, not only with your work with the Fed and central banking, and also gold, all of that, but also really specifically critical minerals. And it really just, it all came to a head just in the last week, as well as just me, again, selling portions of my portfolio and really starting to take you a look into here. So Nomi, people want to know more about you. You don't need any exit intro here, if you would, but if people want to know more about you, want to be in the critical mineral space, want to discuss, read your thoughts on Europe and possibly where to diversify their portfolios in Europe, how do they go about doing all of that?
Sure. I mean, the best place now is I've put it all the PrintSights global stuff onto my Substack. So printsights.substack.com, and it has very various sort of levels of access depending on what people want and a different tiers, but definitely goes through all these topics. We're constantly putting stuff out as well as, you know, specific recommendations and deep sort of boots on the ground analysis and all of that. So that's really the best place.
Excellent. I'll put all of this in the show notes, a link back to you. Nomi Prins, Steve and I are huge fans. We really do appreciate your time, and we'd love to see you out on the road again here, hopefully soon.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
And thanks for signing my book.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
All right. Thank you.